watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On tonight's program, we're going to look at the connections between corporate power and U.S. military activity abroad, and the role corporations have played and are playing in subverting any semblance of democratic freedoms and self-governance at home.
I never took food from the widows and orphans, and never a hard-working man I oppressed. So take your pace easy, go home soon like lightning.
Our first presentation tonight is a remarkable interview with Stan Goff, an author and former military officer whose analysis of the meaning and methods of the Bush administration's war on Afghanistan has grabbed attention worldwide since the appearance of his recent article on the Internet, "The So-Called Evidence is a Farce," which critiques the realities of September 11th. Mike McCormick is the interviewer.
I was hoping you could go through and reiterate everything or a lot of what you'd covered in your article, "The So-Called Evidence is a Farce."
Yeah, well, let me kind of preface that a bit.
Okay.
Because the way that thing got started was that I was participating in a list, and I sent that to the discussion list. Then someone from the discussion list forwarded it to someone, and then it got forwarded to someone else, and now the thing is showing up like in Pravda and places like that. I mean,
okay.
it took off. It wasn't really meant for public consumption, but I still stand by everything I said. I think that while it's important to emphasize that there's a lack of credibility sort of built into the structure of the official story on this, and there's a deep lack of credibility related to whether or not this is a pre-existing agenda, which I think it's pretty clear that it was. I don't want people to think that I'm trying to advance some specific conspiracy theory. I think that's really important to say at the outset, that I don't know what happened on September 11th, and I think it's important to know, but it's even more important to know what is this agenda that's being pursued, because I think it's an extremely dangerous agenda. And I think it can be traced all the way back to as early as 1973 and the first oil shock with the OPEC embargo. So that's my preface.
Okay. So I think some of the strength of your, if I can call it an article now, since it's...
yeah, it's sort of turned into one. Yeah.
But part of that came from your experience with the military, that you are, in fact, what many would call an authority. And I'm wondering if you could give us a brief bio of your experience with the military.
Well, I retired in February 1996. I went into the Army in January 1970, did a tour in Vietnam, came back, did a tour in 82nd Airborne Division, took a little break in service, went back in again. Worked as a CAF scout for a while and went to work at 2nd Ranger Battalion. That was the first of three Ranger assignments. Went to work at the Jungle Operations Training Center in Panama. Went to and then worked in a counter-terrorist outfit that's sort of popularly known as Delta. Left there and went to work as a military science instructor at West Point for three semesters. Had another short break where I instructed SWAT teams and training captains at the Y-12 nuclear weapons facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Went back in the Army on active duty again from a reserve status and ran a Ranger platoon of 1st Ranger Battalion in Savannah, Georgia. Went from there to the Special Forces Qualification Course, entered 7th Special Forces, did a good deal of work in Latin America with them. After 7th Group, I returned back. Working for the regimental staff at 75th Ranger Regiment, participated in the Somali operation, came back from there, was promoted sort of out of that position and back into 3rd Special Forces, where I participated in the Haiti operation. Overall, that tough, you know, there were 8 conflict areas with a great deal of concentration for a while there in Latin America and the Caribbean, but, you know, also some experience elsewhere in Africa and Asia and so forth. But primarily, that work was in the special operations field, which is, you know, this, they're busy boys right now. They're doing most of the heavy lifting, from what I can glean, in Afghanistan right now. And in fact, the overall commander out there, Frank Tony, was a B Company commander in 2nd Ranger Battalion in 1979, 1980, when I was stationed there with A Company right next door. He wasn't very well thought of then. He was thought as an inveterate brown noser, and just the same old folks showing up. They've just been promoted.
And from what little we can get from the media currently, do you think they're accurately portraying what is happening with...
The media has never accurately portrayed a military operation as long as I've been involved with this stuff. I've never seen an accurate portrayal to this day, not one. But then again, I've never seen an accurate portrayal by the military public affairs officers either. So, yeah, the public is kept pretty much in the dark about what, how military operations are really conducted and what may be going on now. And I think we're all being kept deeply in the dark about Afghanistan right now. I strongly suspect that the collateral damage, as they call it, is far worse than they're going to allow anyone to know. And it's a dumb operation. It's just not a very smart operation in a lot of ways. You know, I think it's comparable in many respects to Somalia.
How so? How is it similar?
Well, okay, I have to sort of give you a little background on this. When I was with the Special Forces, we were part of a foreign policy doctrine called IDAD, which is Internal Defense and Development, you know, and Special Forces, basically, it had, you know, 4 primary missions. Some of them were combat missions, but a lot of them were advice and assistance kinds of missions. And that's changed. There's a much stronger doctrinal and technological emphasis now on something called OOTW, or Operations Other Than War, and that's got some sinister implications for us at home, because it really is part of this whole sort of merger between police and military forces. The problem in Somalia and the problem here is related to a military that's still predicated on a structure that was developed out of the Cold War, where we were facing off against the Warsaw Pact. You know, everything was designed to stop the Russians at the foot of the gap, you know. Afghanistan is a far different reality. When I went with the task force to capture Mohammed Farah Hadid, you know, we had all these gadgets, you know, the most technologically sophisticated special operations force probably ever assembled up into that time. And that's why people were stunned, you know, in the United States, when all of a sudden that task force, it comes home, you know, with its dead and wounded and its tail between its legs, and it's been defeated by this feudal warlord. And, you know, there's been all kinds of nonsense written about why this happened, how this happened. You know, there's sort of this perennial claim that politicians keep soldiers from exerting the necessary force, you know what I mean, to get the job done, the same thing they said about Vietnam. But that's all. It's really a military rationalization. It's not real. Because military success is not a function of force or force alone, you know. It's not a function of like geography and weather alone. It's not a function of technology alone. It's not a function of intelligence alone. It's not a function of political context alone. See, it's a combination of all these things. And then you throw into the equation a host of all sorts of other uncontrollable variables, you know, just accidents. And there's, you know, there's no shortage of fools in the military. It's a bureaucracy, and so it sort of breeds these folks. And they have a real strong vested interest in mystifying military operations for the public, because they want the public to sort of leave it to the experts, you know, and ignore their dishonesty, their corruption, you know, accept their little BS excuses for their failures. And, you know, it's a very contagious thing, and I think it's actually infected George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and a whole, all these other, you know, would-be generalissimos that are running the United States right now. What they think they can do is they think they can win in Afghanistan, but, you know, again, going back to Somalia, Afghanistan is similar in I guess, the following ways, okay? Afghanistan is backward. It's tribalistic. You know, it's coherent as a nation only because they've got a boundary around it that says this is a political geographic definition. But within that geographic definition, you see, there is nothing that resembles a nation. You've got the Taliban is one of many, many groups, you know, made in the USA, by the way. But there's not one singular, cogent military force for the U.S. to focus its efforts against, and that's a violation of a principle of war called objective. There's a host of factions. They're all very well armed, thank the United States, you know, because they armed them to topple a socialist regime there years ago. And they change alliances down there like you and I change underwear, you know, in a country that's it's physically divided by some very forbidding and mountainous terrain. There is no infrastructure. You know, you can't attack a society's infrastructure if it doesn't exist. And so it sort of, it nullifies the kinds of strategies they used against Iraq, for instance. And so there's no clear enemy. And without a clear enemy, there's no clear decisive objective. I'm speaking strictly in a morally neutral way here. A military task force can't conquer a nation if there's not really a nation there, you see. So you take this situation and you can introduce, you get all these different warlords and factions, you can introduce a couple dozen Stinger missiles or 500 assault rifles or, like in Somalia, 200 RPGs. And what that does, the introduction to this, you know, comparatively small amount of hardware can instantly shift the entire balance of power in a region and completely change the character of the battlefield. And our military is not versatile or agile enough to respond to that, and moreover, there's still no clearly defined objective. So just from the point of view of the military, it's crazy. You know, Taliban, they claim they have whatever it is, 10,000 or thereabouts, the Afghani Arabs, okay, which are not Afghanis at all. Bin Laden, for instance, is a Saudi. His daddy's a big construction magnate with connections to the Bush family back in Saudi Arabia. 38% of Afghanistan is Pushtun, okay? And even the Pushtun ethnicity is subdivided between the Gilazi and the Durrani, and 25% of Afghanistan are Tajiks, and their loyalties are divided between Afghanistan and Tajikistan. And then the Hazara, who are Shiites, constitute 19%, and they're kind of, you know, prone to favor the Iranians, and the Uzbeks are 6%, you know, and they have loyalties and family inside Uzbekistan and Afghanistan. So, and then you've got a Sunni majority among the Muslims, but you've got a Shiite minority that's fairly significant. Most of the folks there speak a form of Farsi called Dari. That's a Pushtun dialect, but you have Turkic dialects. There's about 30 minor languages alone. And then they say that they're going to make an alliance with this so-called Northern Alliance. It's not even an alliance. It's not even an alliance. The only thing that those people are allied around is their opposition to the Taliban. When they're not allied against the Taliban, they spend as much time bloodletting among themselves as they do doing anything else. And in fact, they've been very opposed to Pushtun nationalism in the past. And the Pushtuns have much closer ties to Pakistan. You see what I'm saying? This is extremely complex, and it's dynamic. It changes from day to day, and there's no way that a great power, unquote, like the United States, can go in there and achieve some sort of a military resolution to the problem. Journalists have called it the quagmire, you know, mission creep and all that stuff, you know, and to me it's like, you know, if anybody remembers their youth and the Uncle Remus stories, I think about Tar Baby, you know. That's what's going on there. This is going to be far more problematic than Vietnam from a military standpoint. I'll hush.
So you mentioned earlier that some of the real reasons that what we're doing in Afghanistan date back to 1973. Could you go into that?
Well, I think, first of all, we just have to be clear that this is about oil. Okay. And when you look at the question of oil, it becomes historically kind of complex. But I'll simplify it as much as I can, sort of what I found out in studying this in detail. Now, got to look at oil production, first of all, as something that's finite. Okay, the Neo-Malthusians now are making some very good points, and I don't necessarily agree with their analysis at a political level, but certainly from a physical level, they're saying the oil is about to run out, and I think that's demonstrable with the data that's available. Oil, as an extractable resource, follows something called a Hubbert curve. And at once it peaks in production, then it begins a very precipitous decline forever because it's a physically finite resource. But it doesn't peak in production in all the same regions. So you've got aggregate world production peaking at one point, and you have different regions peaking at different points along the way. And this really changes the kind of power dynamics that exist between these different regions. In 1973, we got hammered by an oil embargo that was primarily the work of the Gulf states through OPEC. But the Gulf states, to this day, still have the largest repository of recoverable oil. Especially Saudi Arabia, but also Iran and also Iraq. And now some people believe and some people doubt, but there's a fair amount in the Caspian Basin in Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan and around there. So right now the world is consuming somewhere around 75 million barrels a day. Okay, but world oil production as an aggregate is peaking sometime between now and next year. And then it'll begin a permanent decline, aggregate worldwide. The problem is demand is going up so that around 2010, our demand is going to be 100 million barrels a day, which means that demand is going to go up 25 million barrels a day between now and the end of this particular decade. And the problem is, even if everything that they're trying to do right now, an increase in the recovery of oil in the Gulf states and the Caspian, has a potential only with the introduction of around $1 trillion worth of infrastructure to recover 15 additional million barrels a day, which means they still have a $10 million a day deficit, you know, in terms of what their demand is and what's actually available. Now, that's not the real trick. The real trick here is that if you divide the world up, just for the sake of argument, into OPEC, which is primarily Gulf states, Venezuela is also a member, but we're just talking about Gulf states, and we'll call them OPEC. Okay, and then you look at all the non-OPEC, and I just call them NOPEC for the sake of argument, okay? NOPEC production peaked years ago. It peaked in the last decade. It's on the way down. So NOPEC is losing its relative power to control the market. And NOPEC is something that the United States was very heavily invested in for the purpose of offsetting the potential power of the Gulf states as oil producers. But now OPEC is on the rise until 2010. So between now and 2010, OPEC, every day that goes by, gains more power to control the market, the world market for petroleum. The only thing that attenuates that problem for the U.S. right now is that after 1973, they began a very aggressive program of offering all sorts of perquisites to the Saudis and convinced them to invest their petroleum money in U.S. financial instruments, and so the dollar became the petrodollar, you see. Well, when the dollar became the petrodollar, it also became like the foundation currency for world trade, and that's one reason the dollar has maintained strength, is because it's what oil is traded in. The Saudi regime that protects our interests there right now, and some of the other regimes in the region who would potentially protect our interests, are in a lot of trouble. There's a great deal of social unrest. And when you look at them attacking Osama bin Laden in a place like Afghanistan, you have to wonder, since Osama bin Laden represents right now, and I think represents very well, you know, strictly from the point of view of whether they have influence or not, this not Islam, but Islamism, the radical fundamentalism that's taken root in really a sea of declining social conditions over there, because the Saudi standard of living and the standard of living throughout the region, as oil profits have gone down and as corruption has rooted itself further and further in these regimes, has created, again, this ocean of potentially 100 million people whose lives are getting worse all the time. And this is really fertile ground for something like this Islamism, so this radical fundamentalism, to take root. So Osama bin Laden, in a sense, is really the potential opposition in a place like Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is a prize. It is the prize
whoever controls Saudi Arabia controls oil worldwide. And bin Laden himself said a couple of years ago in a public interview that he was going to raise the price of oil to $144 a barrel. Now, I don't know where that number came from or why it was that arbitrary, you know, and specific. But at $50 a barrel, U.S. power dissolves. Our stock market crashes. So they've got some real concerns. And they also have some very specific concerns as individuals, the members of this administration do, because they're also heavily invested in oil, most of them. This $1 trillion worth of potential infrastructure going into the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia is something that Halliburton Oil, Dick Cheney's old company, very well may be contracted to construct. I've got about 6 inches deep worth of research over here, and I don't want to like bore listeners with all the details, but there's more here than meets the eye.
I don't think you're boring us at all with the details. So can you make the connection to potentially the benefits of getting Afghanistan under control for the extraction of oil?
I think it's a pipe dream. I don't think they can get Afghanistan under control. What I've come to believe is that really the U.S.'s ability to dominate the entire planet is unraveling. This is just part of an historical evolution that is at some point inevitable, and I think it's about to happen. I think what they're doing now is not something they're doing out of a position of strength, but out of a position of desperation and panic. These are very panicked kind of moves in sort of broad overall view of things, which makes them exceedingly dangerous. I think historically we can go back and see that when big capital gets in trouble and the market's not working for them anymore, they have to find a way, because right now there is a worldwide production overcapacity that's created a recession that's about to go deep and about to go long. And one of the ways that they've traditionally gotten themselves out of that is to liquidate a bunch of that capital, and the best way to liquidate a bunch of capital real fast is war. That's the way they correct. They probably use non-market mechanisms to correct for a falling rate of profit within a market economy. And I think what's even more dangerous is we're looking at this huge imperial power that's the United States right now, and they're trying to control everything at once, and their empire is beginning to unravel on them. And I think what's particularly dangerous for people like me, and probably people like y'all and a lot of your listeners, is that in the process of doing this, they're going to have to exercise more and more despotic measures at home to step on resistance. And so I think we're really in very serious and immediate danger of an emergence of a form of fascism in the United States. And I think John Ashcroft at the helm of the Justice Department is not a particularly great thing. And I think if people take a close look at the kinds of initiatives he's involved in right now in this bizarre Orwellian sounding the Office of Homeland Security with Tom Ridge of all people, these are very disturbing developments. I think one of the reactions that the public had to the events of September 11th, and it's a very sensible and understandable reaction, is this incredible, you know, sense of a loss of security, an sense of endangerment, and that's being sort of demagogically played out by this opportunistic administration. But I think what people need to understand, and if we're going to appeal to the public at large about what their interests are, I think what's going on right now, the policies that are being pursued by the de facto Bush administration are policies that are contrary to our security and, in fact, a threat to our long-term security. And it's just an attempt to consolidate a citadel of power for a handful of the elite in this country at the expense of everyone else. And it's only a matter of time until they turn on us, too, because this is not a crisis that can be overcome. Oil is running out in the long term, and we have... We have 6 to 7 billion people living on the planet right now that thoroughly depend on this one resource that's not just a regular commodity. It's the lifeblood of the entire global capitalist system. And it's going to be cut off. And it's going to be cut off by nature. It's not going to be cut off by us. But in the process, I think, again, that you'll see a retrenchment of power. And it's that retrenchment that I think is extremely dangerous.
Can you go into some more specifics of how the current policies that the Bush administration is following are a threat to our security?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, start with the notion of going over what I think is really the beginning of a war of extermination among 100 million Muslim people. That don't strike me as something very secure. They wanted to find a good way to go out there and manufacture new terrorists. They're going about it exactly the right way. See, this unilateralism and this willingness to go over there and drop bombs on Afghani civilians, which they are doing. That's exactly why they've cut the media off. But I think there's also some real geostrategic issues. They're introducing a much higher level of tension now between the Pakistanis and the Indians, who've been on the brink of nuclear war with one another already. And I think within a couple of years, when they begin what's going to be inevitably the attempt to break up Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and to pull them away from the orbit of the Russians, I think that's going to create another problem. The Russians are working with us right now, but that's short term. And I think domestically, and again, you know, I go back to this doctrine of operations other than war. You know, worldwide, this recession is going to kick in and create problems in the center, in the industrialized nations, but also in the periphery. And I think they've been very alarmed by the growth of this anti-globalization movement, you know, that people have seen most recently in Genoa, but before that in Quebec and Seattle. And these things are very disturbing, I think, to the power elite right now. And I think we've seen it already over time. There's just closer and closer relationship and blurring of the lines between the military and police. And, I mean, I participated in this. In the early 80s, I was actually involved as an active-duty military in training the FBI's hostage rescue team. They were just WFO SWAT, Washington Field Office SWAT, at the time. So we were militarizing them, and at the same time, they started doing operations with special forces and the Marines, augmenting the Border Patrol. So there was already in progress this developmental trajectory that was beginning to merge the roles of the police and the military. And I think what we're seeing is worldwide, especially, you know, under the influence of the United States, I think there's an hallucination out there of the Pax Americana, you know. And what they're developing now is a military and police doctrine for urban civil war. And for us, that means in the short term that they're developing a doctrine for severe population control. I don't know about anyone else, but that don't make me feel any more secure. That makes me feel very insecure, because it's only a short step before people start getting thrown in jail for what they believe again. You know, I think we're moving toward the reintroduction of something similar to the Smith Act in this country right now.
What was that?
The Smith Act was finally declared unconstitutional, but only after people spent like a decade in jail. That's back in the post-World War II. As part of the whole McCarthyist phenomenon, they introduced something called the Smith Act. Rounded up people who belonged to socialist organizations and threw them all in jail for the crime of thinking. Absolutely nothing wrong. They just put them in jail for their beliefs. And I don't think we're but a hop, skip, and a jump away from that right now.
Well, especially with this week, I believe the FBI is now seeking changing the laws so that they'll be allowed to torture people.
Yeah, did you see that? Or if they can't torture them here, they'll ship them overseas to someone who can. You know, people need to be paying attention. Stop waving that flag for about 5 minutes and go take a real close look at what's going on, because this has nothing to do with patriotism. I care about my country. Heck, I was born and raised here, you know. Members of my family are American citizens. So it's not a question of, you know, this thing of trying to equate the notion of caring about your country with supporting the asinine, dangerous, opportunistic policies of an illegitimate administration. I don't buy it. It's not the same thing. I will never support the Bush administration. I don't care what they do, because, first of all, they weren't elected. People seem to have forgotten that. And that's why I say, man, you know, what's the old thing, cui bono, who benefits?
Go into that some more, if you would, because, again, in your email that you'd sent out that somehow turned into a, through mass circulation, turned into a somewhat famous article now. You talked about how many people in the current Bush administration have connections to oil.
Oh, my goodness. Woo! Okay, well, you know, start with Bush. Start with the de facto president right now. He was the CEO of Harkin Energy. That's his own little company, you know. As it turns out, he wasn't very good at it. You know, his dad was an oil man. So you got two generations in oil right there, okay?
And his dad was also, you know, the former president, former vice president, director of Central Intelligence. George Herbert Walker Bush is on the board of Carlyle Group. Carlyle Group is right now, it's a $12 billion equity company, but it's heavily invested in all kinds of things, including oil, and it's also, I think, the 11th or 12th, whatever, biggest defense contractor in the country right now. So it gets very incestuous. And in fact, Carlyle put Bush Jr. on the board of one of its subsidiaries, which is Carter Air, a little shuttle service, a puddle jumper service, sort of as a, you know, as a sop to dad. The new ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Robert Jordan, is a Dallas lawyer and an old Bush booster. Jordan works for Baker Botts. That's a firm with its offices in Riyadh. And Baker Botts represents Carlyle Group over there. And the Baker in Baker Botts is James Baker, who was the Secretary of State for George Herbert Walker Bush. But he's also the guy that engineered the whole Florida coup d'etat in the 2000 election. He was the midwife of that little venture. Some of the other folks in Carlyle, Fidel Ramos, former chief of the Philippines, Park Tae-joon of South Korea, John Major, everybody remember John Shalikashvili, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And you can go back with the Bush family, Prescott Bush, Rockefellers, DuPont, Standard Oil, Morgans, Fords, all these other folks. They were anti-Semites and anti-communists way back. They actually financed the rise to power of Adolf Hitler. They financed it. I mean, that's an historical fact. It's irrefutable. And Prescott Bush did business with the Nazis all the way up until 1942 until he was censured by the United States under the Trading with the Enemy Act. And after the war, he turned right around and ran for Congress in Connecticut and won. This is an interesting family anyway. But anyway, Dick Cheney, CEO of Halliburton Oil, got $34 million before he took office in stock options from Halliburton. As the CEO, Cheney, and I'm looking at my notes here, oversaw $23.8 billion in oil industry contracts to Iraq alone. Now, this is interesting because Cheney found the loopholes in the embargo in Iraq. Now, the attack on Iraq was done when Cheney was the Secretary of Defense. He stepped down as Secretary of Defense, turned right around, became the CEO of Halliburton, took advantage of the loopholes, and went back there and made $23.8 billion in Iraq by rebuilding the infrastructure that we'd bombed out of existence. Halliburton is also involved with the Russian mob. They've got sort of two things going on. One is oil and the other is drug trafficking. Halliburton is a story all by itself. Secretary of State, Colin Powell. This man has no diplomatic credentials. He's the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and all of a sudden he's in charge of the entire diplomatic corps for the United States. That's interesting by itself. He has cash holdings, or stock holdings in a number of defense contractors. Tony Principi, Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Lockheed Martin, defense contractor, biggest defense contractor in the world. Andrew Card, Chief of Staff, General Motors. Secretary of the Navy, Gordon England, General Dynamics. Secretary of the Air Force, James Roche, Northrop Grumman. Secretary of the Army, General Thomas White, retired. Enron Energy. These folks are all defense contractors or oil people. The whole bunch of them are. Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and what people don't realize is he's also the former CEO of Sorrel Pharmaceuticals. They get big defense contracts, but he's also a General Signal Corporation defense contractor, and interestingly enough, he's also heavily invested in biotech, which is making probably going to make a killing here pretty soon on whatever anthrax vaccines. Cheney, and I've got a picture of Cheney and Rumsfeld in May 2000 at the Russian-American Business Leaders Forum, arms around each other and smiling. Dick Armitage, Deputy Secretary of Defense. He's a guy like me. He's a former Special Ops guy, SEAL. He's had to leave the Reagan administration because he was up to his neck in the Iran-Contra drug problems, and now he's working directly with the Russian mafia. And he's also a board member of Carlyle. Remember that? Chief Carlyle is Mr. Carlucci, who is also with the Middle East Policy Council. You see how this stuff intersects. Commerce Secretary is Donald Evans, who owns the Colorado Oil Company. You have to take a very close look at this cabinet, which I think was constructed in a very systematic way to figure out what the foreign policy priorities are.
Let me also ask you about the actual events on September 11th, mm-hmm. because again, in your email that went out, you had some... you raised some very good questions that I think were on a lot of people's minds as to the exact timing on different incidents.
Yeah. Well, and again, I don't want to imply that there's a conspiracy. It might just be incompetence, but it strikes me as very odd, and I'm sort of looking at my notes here. First of all, every 15 seconds they'd show on the TV these planes blowing up into the World Trade Center over and over. It was like we were trying to be hypnotized by that image, almost as if they didn't want us to think about, well, how did this come to pass, you know? Well, it came to pass in a situation that was unprecedented in the history of the world. Four simultaneous hijackings inside the United States. That has never happened. Never, ever, ever. And hijacked in a span of 25 minutes, 7:45 to 8:10 a.m., Eastern Daylight. And all these planes are on FAA radar. If you fly around the United States, you are on FAA radar. You got four hijackings. Nobody notifies the president. The president's going, he's going to this visit to an elementary school down in Florida. By 8:15, somebody should know something's wrong because these planes have deviated from their flight plans, but nothing happens. The president's, he's skinning and grinning with the teachers and doing his photo op thing. 8:45, American Airlines Flight 11 hits the World Trade Center, okay? 8:45. Now Bush is, he's at Booker Elementary, and we've got four planes hijacked, and one of them's just crashed in the World Trade Center. Still, nobody is notifying the commander-in-chief. No one's scrambled a single Air Force air attack missile or airplane. No Air Force interceptors are in the air. 9:03, United Flight 175 hits the other building in the World Trade Center. 9:05, Andrew Card finally bends over to the president, whispers something in his ear. Okay, the president stop and convene a meeting? Uh-uh. He goes back to reading with second graders. Now they've tracked American Airlines Flight 77. It's over Ohio, headed west, conducts a point turn, unscheduled and off the flight plan, over Ohio, and turns around and starts making a beeline for Washington, D.C. Has Andrew Card been told to scramble the Air Force? No. 25 minutes later, still, the president finally gives a public statement telling people that there's been some hijacked planes flown into the World Trade Center. By this time, we've all seen it live on TV. And meantime, there's this plane that's still headed to D.C. Air Force has still not been scrambled. 9:30, president makes his announcement. Flight 77 is still 10 minutes from the Pentagon. Actually, over 10 minutes. The administration later on tells people that they didn't know that the Pentagon was the target, that they thought it was the White House, but in fact, this was on FAA radar and had shown it had already flown south past the White House no-fly zone and was headed to Alexandria. 9:35. This plane conducts another turn. This is a very strange turn. It's at altitude. It conducts a 360-degree turn and begins a maneuver, a tight spinning descent, a tight spiral descent. This is something that's supposedly, you know, this pilot that was trained at this Florida Puddle Jumper School, you know, where they teach you how to fly a Cessna, has conducted this spiral turn, descends 7,000 feet in 2.5 minutes, brings the plane up, stable, flat, flies it in so low it knocks the electric lines down across the street from the Pentagon, and with 10-point accuracy, slams into the building going 460 knots. Later on, you know, people saying, well, wait a minute, how in the hell did someone learn how to fly a plane that well at this little old school down in Florida? And then people turn around and they sort of add on to the story and say, well, they went to a flight simulator. And what I said in my little post was, this is like saying you prepared your teenager for her first drive on I-40 at rush hour by buying her a video driving game. This don't make any sense. Now, what happened, I don't know. You know, I just don't know. But at a very minimum, and this is what I said that apparently resonated, we either got a criminal conspiracy or we've got criminal negligence on the part of this administration. But in either case, there were parts of this thing that could have been prevented and nobody did a thing. You know, that's what it looks like from where I'm sitting.
To me, that was one of the things that, I mean, so many things in your letter, your article, really resonated with me, but that was one of the things that really stuck out as well, was because I think a lot of us still have questions about that, and none of the media, no one is asking these questions.
But you have to remember that they're also invested in defense companies and oil companies. Westinghouse and GE are some of the biggest defense contractors around, and all of them got oil stocks. It's not like a big conspiracy. You know, what I saw when I was in El Salvador, a lot of the reporters down there
would hang out at the Camino Real Hotel, which is right down the street from the embassy, and they would not dare say anything that would piss off anyone at the embassy, because then the embassy would cut them off from their scoops. See, they would lose their contacts. So they really have to nurture relationships with these power holders, and if they do anything without clearing it with them, then they're subject to be squeezed out and eventually, you know, throws their career off track. So it doesn't, you know, work like from the top down. It's very systemic.
Well, I guess I can understand it with the, you know, with the corporate media not doing that. They're pretty much following a pattern. But even amongst, let's say, the alternative media, there's been very little questioning of the incidents themselves.
Yeah, I think that's part of what I consider an intellectual malaise on the left in the United States. They've deserted their roots, you know, and they forgot how to do analysis. They get involved in this sort of moral scorekeeping. It's almost reminiscent of Vietnam, you know, who has the bigger body count. So people on the left say, well, the Americans have the bigger body count, so they're worse. It doesn't tell us a thing about motives. It doesn't tell us a thing about the trajectory of a system. It doesn't tell us a thing about the historical development of a situation. It doesn't tell us any of that stuff. And I think what the left has really done itself a disservice in getting involved in this sort of tit-for-tat competition for the moral high ground with the right, when they need to be subjecting the situation to some intense analysis and getting people the information they need to begin to ask the right questions. So, you know, I hold sort of hold progressives accountable on that, too. I think we've failed in a lot of ways. It's important to say that politics is hypocritical, but most of us already know that. That's just the nature of politics. It's not designed to be morally consistent. It's a, you know, what they tell you is a story to legitimize an action that has a motive that they can't expose to the public. Otherwise, they'll lose their support. And I think our job is to expose those motives to the public and not just, you know, well, you know, the United States did bad things too. First of all, in a deeply racialized society like ours, it doesn't fly. Most people in this country right now don't care that we're bombing Afghani children. They don't care, because there's already a predominant racist ideology in this country that says that if you're not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant in some case, you know, that you're less than human, that your life has less value. Or if, you know, they get into this jingo patriotism, it's like, I don't care if we kill a billion of them as long as we save one American life. I mean, you know, so we're not going to gain anyone's ear by comparing moralities, I don't think. Some people you will. You know, some people would be called to account on that. But I think we have to appeal to their self-interest, too. And what's going on right now is going to be very bad for most Americans in a very short period of time.
One other question specific to the actual incidents on September 11th. Would it be fair to say that the area around the White House is probably the most secure or the most watched airspace worldwide? Can you think of anything that would have higher security?
I have no idea.
Okay. Well, could you think of anything that would have higher security in terms of airspace than the White House?
It'd be difficult. It's pretty high priority, I would expect. I wouldn't presume to say it's the highest, because I just don't know. But, yeah, you know, you got the most powerful Air Force in the world and the chief of state's resident in that same country. I think you've got a pretty strong assumption right there that that it should be pretty well covered. That airspace should be very well covered.
All right. What do you see we need to start focusing on as a country if we're going to get our country back, basically?
Oh, gosh, I'm not qualified to speak for, you know, I know what I'm doing. I'm getting involved in the organizing where I am. There's sort of two different pieces going on. I think the broader forces need to be brought together in an anti-war movement, to create something for people to plug into as they begin to be disillusioned, as they inevitably will be with this foreign policy, as they've got a movement to plug into, you know, the same as the anti-war movement back during the Vietnam era that finally stopped all that nonsense. And then for people who are like more consciously left or consciously progressive, I think it's really important for us to begin articulating, not just articulating, but beginning to do the organizing around the issue of developing some sort of a nucleus of an anti-fascist movement inside this country. And I think that's been coming for a long time. It's not something that just happened on September 11th. It began with the popular acceptance of books like The Bell Curve, things like that. But I think it has much more urgency now. So I'm involved in anti-war organizing with my colleagues around here and friends. And we're also beginning to talk about what we can do to ensure that we're not subjected to the same thing that Germany was subjected to, because it only took them a couple of years to tumble into barbarism. It won't take us nearly as long because we're much closer to start with.
When anyone questions the current direction that our administration, our government is taking right now, they are called unpatriotic. Would you address that?
You know, they're wrong. But that's the way this works. It's a creation of an atmosphere of intimidation. I have seen and talked to a number of people who begin displaying flags as a form of self-protection, especially Muslim folks and folks from the Middle East around here started hanging flags all over everything they own just as a way to protect themselves, you know. And seen a lot of people in among my African-American colleagues and friends whose neighborhoods now are sprouting American flags like mushrooms after a four-day rain. And these are not folks who are, like, really caught up in this whole patriotic thing, and in fact probably have some very serious reservations about hanging that flag out there when that flag was the one that also flew over slavery and Jim Crow and so forth. But that atmosphere of intimidation is out there. And I think there's only one way to overcome that, and that's for the people who do understand what's going on to be kind of bold and step out. You got to be out front. People have to be aggressive about defending their positions. You have to demonstrate to other people that you don't have to be afraid. Because if we do back away now, that's going to allow this tendency to strengthen, and that's what we can't do. I think you have to fight fascism before it emerges, not afterwards. And to continue to construct a counter-narrative to all this stuff that's official propaganda, to give people information and give it to them, not necessarily a real confrontational way. I don't think I've ever changed anybody's mind by preaching to them. But if you present them with some alternative information, have some time to sit down and sort of process that, then a lot of times they'll come around. A lot of work to do. A lot of work to do.
What are some good sources that you'd recommend for alternative information?
Well, for people who have computer access, there's a number of good websites. Alternet, Indie Media, Global Circle, Emperor's Clothes, those are all websites. Dieoff.org is a very good one to read about petroleum. But also alternative newspapers, depends on where you are. There's usually some close by somewhere. And, you know, there's some books out there, too. Some of the stuff like that Bill Bloom or William Bloom and folks like that have written in the last few years. You know, it doesn't hurt to get a hold of, like, South End or Common Courage Press and see what's on their list and get a few of their books, because they've got some very good analytical and well-documented books out there that talk about the historical development of the situation that we find ourselves in right now. And, you know, listening to shows like this on the radio don't hurt. A lot of people listen to the radio. That's what I do when I'm stuck in traffic, is I listen to the radio. So y'all have a powerful medium, and I appreciate somebody using it for the right thing, you know.
That was Stan Goff, former military analyst and author of Hideous Dream, speaking with Mike McCormick. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. During his interview, Stan Goff mentioned the work of William Blum as excellent background reading on U.S. foreign policy issues. Next, an interview with William Blum on the historical context of U.S. military and covert operations abroad. Jean-Francois and Gretchen King at CKUT at McGill University in Montreal spoke with Blum to explore the connections between capital, foreign policy, and terrorism.
All right, William Blum is with us now on the line from Washington, D.C. Do you see a link between the IMF, U.S. foreign policy, and war? Are you with us, William?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say that the IMF policies lead to war. Well, excuse me, I would, in the case of the Balkans, yes. The IMF devastated the economies of the former republics of Yugoslavia, and that really put a great damage to the cohesiveness of the Union, of the Yugoslav Republic, and that certainly led in great part to the conflicts of the 1990s.
Now, your book, Killing Hope, documents U.S. military history and CIA interventions around the world in the past 100 years, the past century, if you will. And a lot of people in the United States and Canada feel that the acts of terror that have happened in New York City and Washington, D.C. have to be revenged. And that's what we're seeing right now with the bombing of Afghanistan. But tell us a bit about who the real terrorists are, in your view. Who has caused more murder and mayhem in the world? Is it Osama bin Laden, or are there any other people more worthy of blame?
Well, as you imply, my own government is responsible for more of that kind of horror or terror than any other government or individual or group. Since the Second World War, the U.S. government has attempted to overthrow at least 40 foreign governments. They've attempted to suppress over 30 popular rebellions against intolerable regimes. They've bombed at least 25 countries in that time period. And in the process overall, I estimate they've killed at least 4 million people. Their policies have, and they've left millions more destitute and impoverished and suffering in many ways, as all because of the foreign policy of Washington.
It sounds like you're describing a terrorist network.
Well, I would call it that. The supporters of our policy would not call it that. I was on a CBC TV program about 2 weeks ago. You may have seen it, where the question to be debated between myself and one other person who was an editor of the far-right magazine National Review. And the question to be debated was, what is terrorism? And it was getting into these fine points, but not mentioning state terrorism. And so I had to interject that state terrorism was part of any such definition. And I think the U.S. policies have been the leading example of state terrorism in the past half century.
What have been the links between the United States government and the Taliban regime in Afghanistan? Because that's the focus of the world's attention right now. So a lot of people don't see that link.
It's not much publicized that in the late 70s and the early to mid 80s, the Afghanistan had a government which, compared to the Taliban, was very progressive. Even though the leading members of the government were themselves Muslim, they were intent upon women's emancipation, land reform, education for everybody, all kinds of programs which we would call progressive today. And this government was specifically overthrown by the U.S. because it was supported by the Soviet Union. It was a blind Cold War reflex. And we now know that the U.S. instigated the Soviet invasion. It's been admitted to proudly, I would say, by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor to President Carter. And he admitted in an interview in a French magazine 3 years ago, that the U.S., 6 months before the Soviet invasion, the U.S. Was supporting rebels for the express purpose of causing the Soviets to invade, or if not to invade, to increase the probability that they would invade, is the way he put it in the interview. And they did invade, and the rest, as they say, is history.
We're speaking with William Blum, author of the book Killing Hope, U.S. military and CIA interventions since World War II, talking about state-sponsored terrorism, and in this case of U.S. support for the rebels in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union because of the context of the Cold War.
Well, it wasn't at first against the Soviet Union. It was against the government of Afghanistan, the support for the rebels. And the result was that the Soviets invaded. Now, you must keep in mind, this was during the Cold War, at a time when, for example, the U.S. would never have tolerated that there was a communist government in Mexico. Under no circumstances would they have tolerated that. And they knew the Soviet Union could not tolerate an anti-communist government on their border. And so it was supporting any opposition to the government there was almost guaranteed to cause the Soviets to intervene.
How much is the difference, have you seen, if anything, from Cold War U.S. policy to post-Cold War U.S. policy? Do you find that it's more extreme, more intense? Or?
Well, there's no change for the better, certainly, which gives the lie to the whole Cold War myth that we were fighting the Soviet Union. It was not the Soviet Union per se that was the enemy of the U.S. It was anyone who stood in the way of the American empire, whom we call communist. And the fact that our military budget has increased since the end of the Cold War, and we're intervening and invading and bombing as much as ever, because the enemy is anyone who stands in the way of the American empire. And right now the American empire wants to have a government in Afghanistan which will be a pliable client state of Washington, which will allow American military bases to be set up in Afghanistan and to allow oil and gas pipelines to flow through from the Caspian Sea area. Those are the main objectives of the invasion of Afghanistan. It's to put in a government which Washington knows will play ball with it.
It was very interesting. A couple of weeks ago, I was watching Charlie Rose's show, and they had, I can't remember this guy's name, but he was the former CIA bureau chief in Pakistan in the 80s. And he was very skeptical about the United States trying an invasion of Afghanistan. And he went into an interesting history throughout history. Originally, Afghanistan was called the Land of the Unrulable, and people from Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, the British, to even the Soviet Union have all failed in any type of military incursions and invasions, and apparently this is a long precedent. Do you see the United States falling into that trap again in this war?
Well, I think the power of the U.S. military is such that it will not fall into that trap. It'll have some casualties. It's had a few already, but there's no question that they will succeed in overthrowing the government. They first bomb to soften up the enemy. They bomb as much as they need to, and that's been going on for a few weeks now, and it'll continue. And then, if need be, they'll just pour gas or something else deadly into all the caves that they come across, and anyone in those caves will die a horrible death, and perhaps one of those caves will include the Taliban leadership and Osama bin Laden. We may never even know whether his body is found or not.
And you document in your book, Killing Hope, 55 cases pretty thoroughly of U.S. intervention since World War II up into Haiti from 1986 into 1994, and you even have a nice appendix which is instances of use of United States Armed Forces abroad, 1798 to 1945. I'm wondering, in your research and even in your experience in working with the State Department up until 1967, why is the U.S. all over the place? You had mentioned in Afghanistan that there was this desire for oil and gas pipelines to keep them flowing or to establish them in the first place. In these 55 cases that you document, is there always a resource that's in the battle here?
No. Very often it's to teach the Third World a lesson. The one thing the U.S. feared the most during the Cold War in the Third World was the rise of a good example of an alternative to the capitalist model. That's why they have been so hostile to Cuba, because Cuba for 40 years has stood as a possible good example as an alternative to the capitalist model. And so the object in such cases is to make life so difficult for these countries, almost impossible to succeed, that Cuba has suffered greatly and is not as much of a model as it would have been. But even so, it's inspired Latin America for decades. But many of the interventions have been for the exact same reason. Nicaragua and elsewhere, Chile, to overthrow any attempt to provide an alternative to the capitalist model. And whether or not there were resources there, it's not that there was any resource in Cuba that the U.S. is looking for. It was not sugar, but it's the example they have to suppress.